The New England Journal of Medicine has been published since 1812, but it's only been in the last year that it's published a new publication focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. Our guest is the editor-in-chief.
Part of what has happened as in my role in as editor-in-chief of NEJM AI is that I'm very aware of all the governmental efforts in multiple countries about how to regulate this. It's an uncomfortable moment because the questions that you're asking are the questions the governments are asking themselves. What is this?
Right.
What does it mean? How do we safely regulate it?
Dr. Isaac Kahane has spent over three decades trying to harness the power of data to improve medicine. Now the AI era has arrived with opportunities and challenges.
People want us to focus on the bias issues, which are important, but the actual explicit intent of these programs is far more important.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Kahane, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome. And as I noted earlier, that bow tie reminds me that I am really falling down on the job. I see the Harvard professor M.
There's opportunity to improve your status. When we talk about artificial intelligence, AI, there's a lot of confusion. I'm wondering if you could just share with our listeners how you define AI in healthcare.
So I think that defining it is in some sense a fool's errand because the goalposts keep moving. I think that back in the 1980s, automated interpretation of an ECG would have been considered artificial intelligence. Then in the 2018, being able to interpret the retinogram taken of a patient to decide how much diabetic retinopathy they would have would be seen as AI. Now it's being seen as the ability to look through a patient's record and come up with a differential diagnosis, a second opinion, a therapeutic plan. And I think therefore the best definition is one that essentially is a bit of a kicking the can down the road, but it's any computational process that allows clinicians to increase the accuracy and the reliability of their clinical performance and or allows patients to augment their own decision making.
You know, you've just mentioned something that's kind of important, that AI has been around for a while. It's probably only in the public's mind since generative AI has come into place, but you walk through a historical view of AI and its implications.
That's right. And to be fair, I grounded that comment in my own history, where I did my PhD in artificial intelligence back in the 1980s. But truthfully, AI in medicine goes back into the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is this remarkable thing, this remarkable event, where in the fall of 2022, the public was given access at the same time as doctors to a then state-of-the-art large language model that under the hood was only supposed to be able to predict the next word in a sentence, and technically that's what it did, yet functionally seemed to be able to have sophisticated conversations around everything from how to create a rap ode to the president to a genetic diagnosis of a patient.
Well, I think that you've simultaneously given reassurance to everybody in practice today that no matter how long they've been in practice, they in fact are somewhat expert at the use of AI, using the examples that you give, that patients maybe for the last, 10 years or so, at least fairly widespread, have gotten used to patient portals and some degree of automation, but it is indeed a brave new world, as you noted, starting just in the last year or two. You've got the new journal. You're the first editor of the New England Journal of Medicine AI. Tell us about some of the articles that you've published that you think really will stand out when we look back at this moment of time as having moved us forward in giant steps, not incrementally.
That's a great question. I should have anticipated that question and thought harder about it. I have recency bias. And so in the last month, we've published two articles, one by a group that's bicoastal, going from UCSD to Children's Hospital in Boston, talking about the fact that in order to really evaluate AI in medicine programs, just having sort of simulation labs that are being deployed nationwide are not actually sufficient. What we really need is clinical evaluations using clinical trials to evaluate these programs. And I think it's a very important point because what we know now is that just training a program as per a certain FDA threshold does not mean the program is going to behave the same way in different patient populations mm-hmm. with different practices of medicine. There's a lot of localization that has to happen. And there's another article that just came out now with David Blumenthal and a colleague of his, Patel, at Google. And it's about regulation. And they're taking a very provocative view, which I think may actually have some legs, which is that after they summarize the FDA process, they look at the generality of these generative AI programs, which, unlike the programs that were state of the art merely 5 years ago, which had very narrow tasks, such as retinopathy gauging, such as checking if there was a bleed in an MRI of the head. Instead, these generative AI programs can have long conversations that cover a wide area. And so what Patel and Blumenthal are proposing is that we start using the same tools that we use to evaluate human intelligence in clinical performance on these programs, not just taking exams, but have them in the clinical workflow and evaluate how they do. Because as they note, there's a huge difference between how these programs work as a demonstration as opposed to the reality of healthcare. So that's my recency bias in looking at the policy impact. I think that other important articles have been showing how to use particular clinical cases from your own institution to increase the accuracy of these programs. And again, back at the macro level, it's not much of a science paper, but it's a interesting perspective, a study which, looking at clinicaltrials.gov and a WH registry of all the clinical trials happening in the world, showed that yes, there's a lot of such trials happening in the United States and in the UK, but where are most of these trials happening? In China. Mm-hmm. And so we have, you know, and that poses many, many challenges for us. A, because of current political configurations, regulators in China and in the United States don't have particularly close calibration. And it's not very clear how trials run in China pertain and are transferable to US populations. But nonetheless, we have to recognize all the activities that's happening there and recognize that AI in medicine is a global activity. Mm-hmm. And how we embrace that is going to be essential. And part of what has happened as in my role in as editor-in-chief of NEJM AI is that I'm very aware of all the governmental efforts in multiple countries about how to regulate this. And it's an uncomfortable moment because the questions that you're asking are the questions the governments are asking themselves. What is this?
Right.
What does it mean? How do we safely regulate it?
Well, I think that's a good beginning lit search for people to get a primer on most recent research. I want to talk about your role as editor-in-chief and also the attitude and behavior of AI. We understand you're committed to making the publication a trusted authority for promoting the use, and I think you say, of safe, unbiased, and efficacious AI applications. I'm wondering if we can talk about the unbiased part. You know, there's worries AI is just going to replicate the biases we already have in society. How are we going to safeguard against that situation? And how should we frame that issue up?
Well, I think that, and this I hope will be a recurring theme in our remaining few minutes, is we always have to ask ourselves, compared to what? And yes, there are biases in our healthcare system. And these are biases that are implemented by hundreds of thousands of healthcare professionals. How easy is it to unbias those hundreds of thousands of healthcare professionals today? Very difficult. It's almost unimaginable. But you can actually run tests on these AI programs and say, oh, would you propose that diagnosis more often if this was an African-American or an Indian-American? And you can actually adjust these programs to reflect that that bias so that they en masse are changing their behavior. But that raises a kind of opposite question, which is right now, yes, a lot of the biases come from the data, but I think that most people are less aware of how many more biases, most of them with good intent, come from what's called steering or alignment of these models. After these models are trained up, it turns out they will talk about pretty uninteresting things. And so one of the early understandings in the last 3-4 years was that use of reinforcement learning and the so-called instruct model to steer these models towards interesting conversations and to acceptable conversations was important. So, for example, you would not want a program to respond to a person with a detailed request for suicidal procedures or for lethal homicidal procedures. Right. And OpenAI and others have worked a lot on that steering.
Now, and when you say steering, this is really prompting of AI in terms of how we frame up our questions?
It's implemented, it's more than just prompting. What it does is it creates a sort of essentially a layer on top of these programs where it says, here are a bunch of prompts. Here are the kind of answers we're expecting to those prompts.
Right.
And then there's an automation process whereby we start saying to it, give us prompts. And we'll just rate your answers to those prompts. And in a somewhat amusing example of perhaps an overshoot, you know, Google famously in its early steering of Gemini was so concerned about representation that it overshot. And so when you asked it for pictures of Nazi soldiers, they were showing African-Americans or Africans, Nazi soldiers. And so that's being taken care of and it's no longer such a problem. But here's where looking forward, we have to ask what values are going to be inserted in. And you can imagine when you see a doctor, most of the time, until they start talking about the yacht they want to buy, you assume that your interests as a patient are the ones that are being optimized for. Mm-hmm. But who are developing these models? Mm-hmm. Whose interest do they have the most? could be public health, which is not always aligned with personal health. It could be the healthcare institutions, which is also not always aligned. And so those questions are, in my mind, more important than the bias questions.
Well, the well-known phrase, first do no harm, which is always kind of characterized, we think, medicine and all the healing professions, sounds like a good one to bear in mind for all those designers, particularly around the safety and harm issues that you talked about. But, you know, along those lines, we recently had Alondra Nelson, the Biden administration's leader on AI, on the show, who helped design a blueprint for an artificial intelligence bill of rights. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. It's supposed to be focused on ensuring safe, secure, trustworthy technology, as we've been describing. But what are your thoughts about the governmental effort? And are we at a place yet where we're ready to have a bill of rights? And who are the bill of rights for? Patients, healthcare, or is that just one of the long list of questions that you're grappling with?
Well, I think that it's really salutary that the government has moved as it has. But I think even the government would say that all they're doing is providing a framework, not detail. Mm-hmm. And so think about how long medical professional societies wrestle with what's the right time to do a mammogram? Right. When to do
still
a PSA?
Yeah.
And there's no way that a governmental authority can work at that level. And so I think we can have broad brushstrokes, but the actual consequences of it are going to depend on that steering, the insertion of our values, our medical values into it. And you can imagine dystopian things. Well, we just published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine along with one of my faculty, Raj Manrai, where we show that if you take a case of a child who is borderline growth hormone deficient and short, the advice given is very different when you tell it to give the advice as a insurer or as a pediatric endocrinologist.
Ooh.
And so those are not, and those are, of course, real reflections of the system.
Right.
And so these are not invisible bias questions. These are steering questions, steering and alignment questions. And I think that in some sense, it's a misdirection. People want us to focus on the bias issues, which are important, but the actual explicit intent of these programs is far more important. Mm-hmm. I will say, because I know that we have finite time, I want to also focus on the fact that we have to compare the deployment of these AI systems to the current state of the art. And I can tell you that when I have faculty coming to my department for the first time that we just recruited, and they come to me and they say, Zach, where am I going to get my primary care? I've done this enough times to know that I cannot get them good primary care in Boston, at this central mecca of healthcare. If you look at Mass General Brigham, all the primary care clinics are not accepting new patients anymore.
Right. Hence the famous headline, nobody can see you now, in the Boston Globe not too
long
ago.
Well, you know, we are in the primary care space, and we understand that very clearly. It's a real public health crisis that Americans have to deal with. I do want to go talk a little bit about the regulatory.
Wait.
Go ahead.
So here's my point. In that context, consider the case of a child who was having difficulty walking, difficulty chewing, intractable headaches, was seen by 17 doctors over 3 years, multiple imaging studies, no diagnosis. The mother was told at the end of 3 years she should consider having this kid seen by a psychiatrist. The mom, non-doctor, takes all that text from all the reports, shoves it into GPT-4, and GPT-4 says, this could be tethered cord syndrome, where the bottom of the spinal cord is trapped in the bones. And so she goes to a neurosurgeon where she lives in Michigan and asks the neurosurgeon, could this be tethered cord? Neurosurgeon looks at the imaging studies, says, yep, that's what it is. They do the surgery. The child's cured. Now, what had happened is that originally the imaging had been misinterpreted. And then everybody never looked at the original image. GPT-4 didn't get to see the image either, but it could infer from all the findings what was going on. So my point is, in the era where patients do not have access to the conversations in primary care, where even if they do have access to primary care after N months, it's a very short visit and they have more questions, they're out of luck. We have to ask ourselves, what is the risk-benefit ratio of providing patients access to this with all its warts, given the fact that they do not have access to expert care? And the alternative, the other alternative, Dr. Google search, has many, many more problems. And therefore, I think that the reality-based conversation is, what is this, the meaning of having unleashed this intelligent program with all its flaws in our healthcare system where we're falling down on the job?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. And we subscribe to this view that our patients actually have a lot of AI that they don't they will probably use, which is actual intelligence, where they will take that information and put it in the appropriate things and strive for the answers. I want to talk about the regulatory environment. You talked a little bit about China. America really has, it's sort of wild, wild west. They haven't really given any guidelines. The EU is much different, though. They've progressed further. What's your sense of this regulatory environment? Because it's going to have a big impact on researchers and on advancements.
Well, I think that it's a complicated question because of the fact that on the one hand, you're right, there's not a whole lot of actual definition of what constitutes acceptable clinical performance in this country. But I held a conference in Maine, an international conference, just an invitation only, with around 60 experts from around the world back in October of 2023. And what was very interesting is after the conference, a lot of the Europeans came to me and they said, we're really thankful to come to your conference, that we came to your conference because, yes, there's a lot of advanced legislation coming forward in Europe, but it's all about the harms and the risks, and it's not about the potential benefits. And we have 400 million citizens who are probably getting inadequate care. And so I would hypothesize, based on this kind of feedback and others like it, that there is, on the one hand, a fearful and overly focused on risk approach that ignores the potential benefits, and on the other hand, a totally laissez-faire system where we're not asking on which data was it trained, to ask for transparency, how is it being aligned or steered. And because it's early days, it's possible that we get locked down in one or more of those extreme modes. But I'm optimistic, actually, that there are leaders of goodwill in all these different countries. And so that after some possible early missteps, they are actually going to focus more on the middle, which is a balance of risk and benefit, given the current performance of our healthcare system. And so that is a conversation that has to include the not only patients, but all the medical societies. And I would argue that the medical societies have been way too bashful, too shy. They need to be engaged right away in this conversation. Yeah. I wrote a book back in the end of 2022 with my friend Kerry Goldberg and Peter Lee, the president at Microsoft, head of Microsoft Research. And we wrote the book about GPT-4 and in medicine and beyond, because we felt there was not a conversation happening. And there would be a bunch of advanced policymakers who would know about it, and some advanced technologists who would know about it. But this is fundamentally how do we see ourselves as a society question.
Yeah.
It's a values question. Yeah. And that's why your podcast is so important. We need to engage our healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
And I see a great counterexample of how not to do it in what happened to electronic health records. Mm-hmm. We decided that electronic health records were not our job. It was the job of the chief information officer and the C-suite in our hospitals. And because of that, we abdicated all responsibility in the usability of these products, mm-hmm. in what job they got done. And as a result, we contributed mightily to disaffection, moral injury, and
great analogy.
Burnout.
Yeah.
Doctors.
And part of why there's fewer primary care providers.
That's right.
To see people. But, you know, I want to just stay on that point for 1 minute, and I know we're getting close to the end, but there is a, you know, there's a pattern of it taking a long time to bring into the education of our next generation of healthcare professionals, providers, everybody, these kinds of mega changes that will really affect the course of care and the course of their careers. What are you hearing, seeing in terms of schools of medicine, nursing, dentistry, other schools really embracing, including the use of AI in their medical education programs?
So I think that at the top, at leadership medical schools, there's real interest in including AI as an interesting part of education. But that turns out to be very hard to do, because shifting medical education is one of the really hard lifts.
Right.
So I can tell you the dean of the medical school at Harvard, for example, George, is very determined that this should happen. And yet a lot of our faculty are not yet using it in that fashion, and therefore I think would have some difficulty teaching it. We'll make progress, but what's clear is our students today are already using it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's an odd situation where the medicine of the future is clear to our young students, and our establishment is not very clear how to educate it.
Let's talk a little bit, just a one last question about the future. AI isn't sentient yet. 5 years out, where will we see this future of AI in your mind?
So I think it's going to be, because we're seeing a broader workforce problem in pediatrics, in primary care, in geriatrics, it is, I think, 5 to 10 years from now, you'll see an increasing fraction of non-MD professionals, such as nurse practitioners, physician assistants, augmented by AI to perform at a very high level. You'll see a lot of the interpretive studies, such as echocardiograms, being interpreted not by cardiologists, but directly from the echocardiographer, who's not an MD, going through an AI to give a very detailed cardiac readout to the primary care professional who might not be an MD. And so I believe you'll see in the 5 to 10 year throw a lot of non-classical MDs, clinicians, using AI routinely as an augmentation. And I also predict this. This is the United States, after all. A kick in the pants from a few legal cases where someone missed something because they did not use AI.
Mm-hmm. Well, nurse practitioners and physician associates are already 50% of the workforce in primary care and community health centers, and more than that in many communities. So it's great to have an additional tool. But the good news is, when we say who will see you, they're answering the question much of the time. But Dr. Kahane, thank you for your thoughts, for your work, for your insights. And thanks to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for our email updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about this program and all our programs. Dr. Kohany, thank you so much. The journal is terrific, and we look forward to continuing to learn from it.
Thank you very much, and what an interesting conversation. I really appreciate
it. That's great.
Thank you. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.